from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour, historian Simon Shama's new five-part PBS documentary, The Story of the Jews, covers 3,000 years and explores the history of Jewish culture from ancient times to the present.
What ties us together is a story. A story kept in our heads and hearts.
We told our story to survive.
Simon Shama joins us in the studio to talk about the series, The Story of the Jews, and the two-volume illustrated companion book of the same title. Join us for Forum next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Simon Shama joins us in studio for this Forum hour, a British-born historian and Columbia professor of history and art history. He's the author of a wide range of books, including books about the French Revolution, Britain, Rembrandt, America's Future, and the National Book Critics Circle Award-winning book, Rough Crossings, about escape slaves who joined the British cause during the American Revolution. He is also responsible for some 40 documentary films covering writers from Dunn to Tolstoy and the five-part BBC TV documentary series A History of Britain. And more recently, a five-part series on 3,000 years of Jewish history, which was featured last fall on the BBC to wide acclaim. It airs on PBS stations here in the United States beginning March 25th. The series is accompanied by illustrated cultural history texts of the same title, The Story of the Jews. And the first volume takes us from 1000 BC to 1492 AD and is subtitled Finding the Words. Simon Shama joins us in this morning's second hour. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much.
Pleased to have you here. And, boy, we're doing a lot for Columbia University professors. This recent last hour, Brian Greene, Rashid Khalidi earlier last week.
But my institution would be duly grateful, Michael, actually. How would you like an honorary degree?
I'll take it.
Good.
Any kind of COVID will be...
Consider it done. I'll deal with the authorities later.
Well, it's good to have you here.
It's a pleasure.
And this first volume, Finding the Words, says a lot because we're talking about a people of the book. Ira Glass once said to me that there are two kinds of Jews. I mean, it sounds like a facile remark, but he said there are book Jews and money Jews, and it's a bit overly simplified, to be sure, but always have been people of the book.
That's a terribly good point. I just instantly thought, sorry, everybody out there, because I'm about to say a non-Jewish, in fact, possibly anti-Semitic writer, namely T.S. Eliot, who was, of course, worked in the
bank. Possibly anti-Semitic?
No, Michael, absolutely right. Grotesquely anti-Semitic. But he was a banker, of course, for a while. He worked in a bank and did his poetry. Can you and I think of a banker who then also produced, you know, Jewish literature? Probably not. We can think of ministers of finance who did this.
Well,
Shmuel Nagrela, the poet, the medieval poet, was a kind of a sort of treasury secretary for the caliph of Granada, and he wrote beautiful poetry.
Well, I never understood how Wallace Stevens could be an insurance executive, but he was indeed. But let's talk about this whole notion of people of the book and get into the whole sense of Jewish history and its connection to Talmud, Torah, Mishnah, Gemara, all those kind of texts. It's indisputable, I think, that it can't be separated from that almost from the beginnings, yeah?
Right, right. No, that's absolutely correct, I think. I mean, I suppose that in its very earliest beginnings, most scholars, and there are going to be some scholars out there famously in San Francisco who can disagree with me, but most scholars, as I understand it, think the Bible began to be written in earnest around the 8th century BC, while the Kingdom of Judea was still alive, but not particularly kicking, and it was going to go down for the count. But what is striking is that in that very early period, you know, Judeans or Jews or Israelites are not so unlike other peoples as they were to become, I think, afterwards. And like other peoples, a lot of the Book of Kings, for example, is triumphalist. That's to say, there's an assumed reliability in the relationship between God, the God who marches through history, and kings and leaders. But even in those early books, if you think about it, There is a degree of extraordinary uncertainty. Jews talk back to God. God talks back to Jews. Moses does not really want to be pinned to the role to which he's assigned. I am a stammerer. When you get deeper into the Bible, Jonah is furious with God for not punishing the sinners of Nineveh more thoroughly as he was supposed to do. So you have this extraordinary sense in which that those who have the words actually are not simply unproblematic expressions of God's militant destiny for their triumph. So there is this extraordinary kind of slippage, I think, which is so interesting. In other words, the way Jews write about their history in the Bible is less monumental. It's less simply to do with the march through history of divinely engineered omnipotence, and more to do with self-interrogation, backsliding, earthly impurities, a rather bad-tempered God who accompanies you unpredictably through your passage through time. And that is a wondrous kind of poetic invention, I believe.
Well, it is indeed. And I'm also struck by the fact, and you kind of intimated this, at how much Jews have been able to live in other cultures, not necessarily, and I think this is something that you kind of bring home in your work, in such a separate or divided way, but very much a part of the communities that they were in, whether it was in Egypt, whether it was in Greece, Rome, etc. Right. I even discovered in your work that there were Jewish catacombs in Rome, but
there
that's a kind of separation. But they lived within these communities, contributed to them, absorbed them, and so forth.
Absolutely.
And it was very symbiotic.
Yeah, it starts again incredibly early. We have no archaeological evidence the Exodus happened. That doesn't mean say it didn't, but we have no evidence for it. But what we do have is the extremely archaic Song of the Sea, Miriam's Song of Triumph, at the drowning of Pharaoh's host in the Red Sea that we remember every Seder, every Passover. And that is very similar to other so-called West Semitic or even Phoenician triumphs about the storm god who can part the waters. But we, you know, the Bible writers make it over into a very particularly Jewish story. So that already sets the table whereby you take elements of the culture in which you're placed and you turn them into something that is both universal and particularly about your own identity. Now, if we go to fast forward a lot to the Greek period, for example, where everybody, every little boy, including me, grew up with the Hanukkah story. By the way, everybody out there, I'm sure you know this, but the miracle of the oil is not mentioned at all in the Book of Maccabees. It's an entirely rabbinic invention of the early Middle Ages. Of the
fourth
century.
What else is an invention? Making it of the status of Christmas somehow so yeah. The kids can not feel left out. I mean, it's a military victory, basically.
Yes. And we're all taught that, you know, that Hellenism and Judaism, Greek culture and Judaic culture, as certainly happened during the period of the demented king Antiochus Epiphanes IV, were always incompatible. But at that very time, Jews speak Greek, they translate the Bible into Greek, they wear Greek clothes, they make Greek tombs and Greek architecture for themselves.
Yeah, thank you, Matthew Arnold, for making that binary for us.
Yes, that's right, and Heiner as well, but certainly Matthew Arnold was the first person to say, you're either Greek or Hebrew, and that absolutely is not the case. After the initial Hasmonean revolt is over, the next set of Greek kings in Syria are perfectly happy to let Jews proceed along with their traditional religious practices and rites. It's not a problem.
Which in Syria included some radiant wall paintings within the synagogue.
Yeah, that's a bit later on in the 3rd century AD, but that is an astonishing place. It's called Durioropos. I wanted to film there, Michael, but I'm old, I'm reckless. I thought we could charter a helicopter and be in and out of there. The civil war had started, but it had not got to Damascus. This is an extraordinary place. I fear for, we don't quite know what's happened to the site, but there's not much left of the actual columns. But what there is are these extraordinarily brilliant dry frescoes of Bible paintings. So this is one of the earliest synagogues at all that we know about. It's covered with pictures of Esther and Mordecai, of Moses, of David, of Samuel. The Jew who commissioned it, we know, was called Samuel, so he's very big on the life and times of Samuel. These are, some historians, I'm not quite sure I agree with them, think that Jewish place of worship paintings came before Christians. There's certainly Christian icons and Jewish icons, as it were, are going along together, parallel to each other, at this city in Syria. So that's a kind of thrilling thing and makes you rethink what the Second Commandment meant when it said you'll have no graven images. What it must have meant is you shall have no sculpture, no idols in that way.
It's too bad you didn't go to... I mean, I can see it now. Simon Shammah on the road to Damascus, like Saul of Tarsus. And we're talking, by the way, with Simon Shammah, who now has the glorious title of Danton Rabbi, as opposed to Danton Abbey. And... who is the author of 15 books, contributing editor of the Financial Times, and The Story of the Jews with Simon Shammah airs Tuesday, March 25th and April 1st, starting at 8 p.m. on our own KQED Channel 9. This is, for you, very much a personal odyssey. I mean, I want to get into that with you to some degree, because you've said that what brought you into being a historian had a lot to do with your own connection to Jewish history or wanting to tell this story.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I as I often say, I was born in 1945, very early on. My father was obsessed with both Jewish and British history and even saw a kind of mysterious connection that was somewhat to do with the fact that the British had sponsored the Balfour Declaration, somewhat to do with Churchill, who was a great Philo Semite, but also a working, stiff historian. On his bookshelf, I remember seeing Chaim Weizmann's Trial and Error next to the History of the English-Speaking Peoples. If you were growing up in that rather austere, broken, tweedy, dark brown soup of a world of England in the 1950s, the place you went to commune with the dead in a kind of childishly romantic way was either the Bible or Shakespeare, the Shakespeare history place, and to which I'd add Dickens and Walter Scott as well. And there I went. And, you know, as you grow up, you realize that history is a critical discipline. It's meant not just to tell stories, not just a kind of swashbuckling march down memory lane, but it's also meant to keep you awake at night, tell stories about your own sense of who you are and where you've come from. So that was very deep. I mean, the bits of the Bible I loved is where names of kings that I can't even remember now bash the living daylights out of each other. And I used to love the Old Testament for its sort of blood-boltered extravagance. The New Testament seemed to me like thin porridge in comparison. You know, it was full of a kind of milky evangelism, which I couldn't bear. Sorry, everybody out there.
Well, let's hear something from your new documentary. And what I want to hear is a clip where you talk about the relationship between ancient Jews and early Muslim communities.
In our own age of bitter hatreds, it's not so easy to believe, but over 1,000 years ago, Cairo was home to one of the most thriving Jewish communities in the world. And that story was repeated across the Eastern Mediterranean and in Arabia itself. The birthplace of a powerful new monotheistic faith, Islam. With no accusation of Christ-killing to contend with, Jews under Islam were spared the demonization they suffered in Christendom. According to later Islamic sources, there seems to have been an early moment when Jews and Muslims might both have been part of the Ummah, common community of believers.
Well, that's a fascinating piece of history in itself. There's even a chapter in your book called Muhammad and the Cohens of Arabia. I mean, things were very different I mean, in terms of living and let living and living together. Yeah. As you say, nothing to have to deal with matzah being made out of Christian blood and all of that sort
that's
of thing.
Right.
And there was alliances and friendships. And
well, it's often forgotten. And this is something I was able to do in much more detail in the book. But thank you very much for playing that. It is a very important, profound moment. People have to remember that Arabia in the two centuries before Islam arrives has an extraordinary Jewish community. Some of them are Judean migrants into Arabia, but a huge number of them are ethnically Arab converts to Judaism, sometimes forced converts. The Hasmonean kings made forced converts out of local ethnic groups around and beyond Palestine. And the most extraordinary...
Was it karma under Ferdinand and Isabella then, that they converted all those Jews in Spain?
Yeah, exactly. But there were Jewish Arabs, basically. There are very, very large numbers of Jewish Arabs. The great state, the most powerful state on the Arabian Peninsula in the 5th century AD was a place called the Kingdom of Himyar, which archaeology is unearthing even as we speak. And this was a full-on Orthodox Jewish Arab world. So this is why Muhammad was, you know, he was Yatrib, which became Medina, was a Jewish mercantile city. Why Muhammad had such high expectations that when actually he revealed himself to be the prophet, it would be a natural fit with Jewish practice. And of course, writes about pure and impure foods, about a day of rest and worship, all sorts of things that we now think of as automatically Islamic were there in a kind of Jewish matrix. And it was when the Jews of Medina, in particular, of Yatrib, repudiated, felt that we no longer live in the age of prophets, therefore you can't be the prophet, and repudiated his idea that Ishmael is really the star of the story of Abraham and his sons, that Muhammad becomes so vexed with the... But it also means that throughout the long centuries that followed, there was this extraordinary kind of cousinhood, really. It was not necessarily a cousinhood of entirely predictably benevolent reciprocity, but it was a genuine kind of kinship between Jewish and Muslim existence. And
so much to talk about, I mean, in this work that you've done. But let me push in a different direction for a moment. I want to get back to some of the things you bring up and actually take us, if I can, maybe even to Ferdinand and Isabella before, well, not necessarily even before, but almost consanguine with what was happening in terms of discovering America, Jews being tortured in Torquemada and all that. I mean, this first book really takes us right up to that from the year 1000. But you think about Jews, you think about, well, Philip Roth, I think about it, once made a distinction between Judaism and Jewishness. So there's the identity and then there's the religion. And you talked about the discipline of being a historian, and you talk about archaeological versus biblical histories and the two, and maybe the two often meet, but all as much often don't meet. I'm wondering just about the definition. To many people, being Jewish is a religion, being Jewish is a, being a Jew is a member of a tribe, of a people, of a people of history and stories. Alfred North Whitehead, I think it was, who said a Jew is someone who continues to ask the question, what is a Jew? What have you come away with from all of this study and erudition that you have just in terms of defining what it means to be a Jew?
Well, it's clear, I think, actually, if you empty Jewish identity of all religious content, you don't have a huge amount left. That doesn't necessarily mean that you assent to everything that's comprised in orthodoxy. What is surprising, I think, is actually right from the beginning, if you just take the contradictions in the first five books of Moses and the Torah, you already find a certain amount of elasticity in actually what constitutes strict adherence to the orthodox rule. I once gave a lecture, you might or might not be surprised to hear, Michael, called Are Locusts Kosher? And the answer is, if you look in the book of Leviticus, they are, they're crunchy birds. And if you look in Deuteronomy, they're not. Having said that, of course, actually, here's, in the first program, we begin not with Abraham, but with Sigmund Freud. And Sigmund Freud's teshuvah, his return back. He'd never, ever fudged his Jewish identity. In fact, he would get very, very cross with shifty, furtive Jews who would rather pass for something else. But he was, as he said, a godless Jew.
He tried to de-emphasize Moses too, though, in Moses and Monotheism.
Well, no, that's my beloved late colleague, Yosef Yerushalmi, wrote the best book about this, I think, called Freud's Moses. And Yosef said something very profound, I think, that although there's an utter crackpot version of who Moses was, namely he was the last priest of the monotheistic cult of Akhenaten in Egypt, and when Egypt reverts to polytheism, to paganism, this Moses is looking around for a likely bunch on whom his determined monotheism can be projected, and he finds this scruffy bunch of half-enslaved Hebrews. This is completely meshuggah, as we say, and then they don't like it, so they kill him. But all that is madness and was taken from an earlier, equally mad German scholarly book. But a large part of Moses and monotheism is the consequences of that. And Freud's view, which reflected his own sense, was that however it arose, the destiny and the acceptance of the Jews to say that we are bound together by moral norms, by a set of ethics, however we argue about how this came about, we understand that true humanity is really from the neck up. In some sense, it's a humanity of reflectiveness, of self-interrogation, of an inquiry into the moral decency which could govern our relationships between ourselves and with other people. And that has been our fate and our role, and it's left us defenseless against those people who've chased me out of Vienna, the Nazis. Those powers in the chronicle of human history who depend on force, on territory, on a sense of kind of atavistic tribal rootedness, are not us. We are wanderers with the word and with our minds. And that is something which he embraces. And that is, I think, what Philip Roth and everybody else has in mind when they...
Especially secular Jews and perhaps those who are not observant. But
right.
Where does Kessler come in your mind with all this theory about the Khazars? And
well, he doesn't... this is an extraordinary story. And you have to... Kessler felt that really all Ashkenazi men descended from the Khazars. There's absolutely there's no evidence for that at all. But what is, hey, everybody out there, we have a Crimea story going here, because Crimea was one of the centers of the Khazar Empire, which is a Caucasian ethnicity, who convert to Judaism. There's no doubt about this, because we have confirming documents in the Cairo Geniza, this great medieval repository of documents. We have letters that I go into in the book from Hasta ibn Shaprut, from some of the dominant figures in Muslim Spain, dominant Jews.
And forgive me, they were a lot of bankers. They didn't want
to
live under the usury laws.
Indeed they were. But there's no doubt that this actually happened, and that this extraordinary kind of Turkic Caucasian empire, at least the monarchy itself and most of the aristocracy, were less sure about the ordinary people, become Jewish for a number of centuries. And but what happens when the Khazar Empire disintegrates at the hands of the Mongols, in the 13th century, but even before that, where they go to is unclear. There are plenty of places for them to have gone to, Persia, where we now think of Turkey, the Middle East, for them not necessarily. It does say that Judaism has often been a proselytizing religion. Ask most Jews, they'll say we always eschewed proselytism. This is absolutely not true. What we do in a Jewish way, though, which is in the Talmud, which is wonderful, there's instructions to rabbis when potential proselytes come before them. And the rabbis basically have to deliver the most ominous Surgeon General's warning, saying, you really want to do this? Do you understand, you want to join our bunch? Do you know how hard this is going to be? Believe me, being a Jew is no picnic. Look around, I will tell you stories. And the proselyte says, yes, I want to come. I love the cooking. I love the music. I love the hairdos. I want it. And he said, there's adult circumcision. Yes. Well, how bad can that be? Then you can say yes.
Well, a lot of the notion of Jewish history has been tied, especially recently in many people's minds, to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict,
yeah,
to the Shoah, or the Holocaust. And in many people's minds, we have a perhaps greater depth of history to the diaspora and the victimization, and maybe even more contemporary, as you pointed out, I think, to bullying, some who see things in that light. I think what you've done here, and it's quite extraordinary, is given us a lot of the nuances of the history,
Michael.
A lot of the multidimensional sense of the history.
That was the attempt, yeah.
Well, it's an attempt that's successful. I mean, you understand a great deal more about this people and about their heritage and about their legacy and perhaps about their future. And it's an opportune time for me to invite those of you listening to join this conversation with Simon Chama. We certainly would like to hear from you if you have some thoughts. Some questions or comments, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your calls. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And, of course, you can tweet us as well. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Talking with historian Simon Chanda, his new 5-part PBS documentary, The Story of the Jews, explores the history of Jewish culture from ancient times to the present day. It will debut on KQED Television March 25th and April 1st at 8 p.m. on Channel 9. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Simon Chama, professor of art history and history at Columbia, and contributing editor of the Financial Times. The documentary that he's done called The Story of the Jews with Simon Chama airs Tuesday, March 25th and April 1st, starting at 8 p.m. on KQED 9. There's also a book, The Story of the Jews. I want to actually hear another clip from, although, as I said, the first volume of the book takes us right up to Ferdinand and Isabel and the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. They're not welcoming them back. They're giving them all kinds of enticements to come back to Spain after these many centuries. But
that's a very interesting story, Michael. It goes back to the 1920s, actually, when they were first given Spanish citizenship.
I thought we'd hear a clip from the film, though. Here you are, Simon, visiting the Berlin Holocaust Memorial.
I like to think that the humanity of the Enlightenment idea was not entirely cancelled out by the inhumanity of its incineration. To declare anything else is to declare victory for the murderers. I do know I grieve endlessly for those here in Berlin and all over Europe who innocently imagined they could be Jews and citizens of their own countries, and who, to the end, could not imagine the evil that would turn their books and their bodies into ash.
Well, notwithstanding the exception of those Holocaust deniers, many of them born and raised in places like Alabama and Southern California, this kind of history and the grimness of it that one associates with the Holocaust comes across. You have a chapter in your book called The Women of Ashkenaz, for example, mm-hmm. where you talk about the murders and massacres during the time of the Crusades. Mm-hmm. And then we go up to the Spanish experience where they were burning Jews alive for mass entertainment. I mean, this is a curve throughout history.
Right, right. It was actually, one should be a bit clear that the terrible year, actually, the terrible moment when tens of thousands of Jews are killed is actually fully a century before the expulsion in 1391, when horrendous mob riots take the lives, well, basically exterminate the great Jewish community in Barcelona. Everybody out there who've been to Barcelona, a wonderful place, and go to an enjoyably beautiful park called Montjuïc in Catalan is called that because it was actually originally the Jewish cemetery, and there are bodies up there when you next take your – don't want to spoil your picnics.
Can I tell you a quick story, actually, because when I was in Barcelona, there was a guide, a young woman, very thoughtful young blonde woman, and looked kind of Nordic but was wearing a Jewish star. And I asked her just out of curiosity. I said, are you Jewish? And she said, yes, but many are claiming they are and they don't really know because the records are not even available.
Right.
So there's been this kind of turning or burgeoning in Spain of those finding Jewish identity, seeking
it. Well, dear Michael, also in New Spain, I mean, this is going on in New Mexico and Arizona. There's an extraordinary website called Culano, All of Us, which is actually helping to, because DNA swabs are revealing extraordinary things. No, I wanted to say that 1391 is truly frightening. So basically, a third of the Jewish community in Spain are killed, a third stay loyal to Judaism, but a third convert. And it's precisely because the Spanish monarchy, first of all, congratulates itself and the church on this mass conversion, but then starts to feel very uneasy about whether it's a genuine Christian conversion, that the Inquisition is instituted to root out those who are fake Christians and who are observing secret Jewish ceremonies, as indeed was the case, from the real Christians. And it's those fake Christian secret Jews who indeed, as you say, are burnt in very large numbers at auto da fe for mass entertainment.
Also, a great deal, of course, I've learned from you, but always thought, you know, that a lot of the Christian anti-Semitism certainly went back to Martin Luther and in Germany, I mean, specifically, but also way before then because of the unwillingness to accept the messianism of Christ. A lot of the former Jews, like St. Paul, were very angry about it. The divinity of Christ.
Especially the divinity of Christ.
And yet, a lot of Christians, I learned from Simon Chama, were offended by the fact that the religious services of Jews were not in silence.
Yes. Well, they were startled, and this goes on a long way. For example, when the great diarist, English diarist Samuel Pepys, is taken by his friend Mr. Robinson into the earliest London synagogue in a place called Creechurch Lane in the city, he is absolutely horrified, actually, about everybody shouting and talking and interrupting each other, and that the fact that the service is so noisy. And I take that all the way back to, and certainly I don't know what your synagogues were like, but certainly the ones I grew up in were exactly like that. And I thought, well, it's not just really the fact that we can't shut up, but it's true we can't, but the word kriya, when we on Shabbat and the festivals, we talk about the kriyat Torah, the reading of the law, it is meant to be a vocalized reading. You know, it's monks who really do silent reading of meditative sacred scripture when chants are not being done. But the point about when that wonderful passage in Ezra and Nehemiah, when we know that Ezra stands on a wooden dais in the half-completed, reconstructed walls of Jerusalem with the beginnings of the rebuilt Second Temple, and summons everybody, men and women and servants, to listen to the reading. It's important that it's reading out loud because it's meant to be a shared communal experience, a public communal experience. And when, you know, we raise, instead of some sort of image of Christ or a pagan god, we raise our words in the synagogue and process around and kiss the hem of the Sefer Torah, we're celebrating a kind of necessarily vocalized event, I think. And
well, celebrating the law, really.
Yeah, but celebrating it out loud, yeah. Really. It is the sense. I mean, I say at the end of the first program, it would be a spoiler, wouldn't it, Michael, actually, to say, but there's something I have to say about the way the Romans contemplate their triumph over the Jews. And they don't take into account that what will endure will be the loudly spoken word, rather than simply lying down, accepting that you're vanquished and uprooted.
I want to get to our calls and emails, but first, just a quick question about Josephus, who you say is the first real historian because he introduces his mother, first Jewish historian. There's been, you know, a lot of controversy over Josephus' reliability, yeah, and everything, because there's certainly, when you're trying to trace the origins of the historical Christ, a lot of people go to Josephus as the source of that, and just how reliable Josephus is, considering that he became kind of a tool for the Romans in many respects. What's your take on that?
Well, it's always, you know, he's our only source, really, for the detailed history of the great Jewish rebellion against Rome. And, you know, that's always going to make historians uneasy. You have nothing really. You do have subsequent sources, but they're all Roman sources again, Tacitus and so on. And there are other sources of, but you don't have really anything. There is nothing from the Jewish side to check Josephus against. But he's such an extraordinarily complicated figure. He's Yosef Bar Matityahu. On one side, he's from Hasmonean royalty. On the other side, he's from the priestly family. He spends, you know, some of his teenage years really studying with a kind of Qumran-like Dead Sea Scrolls guru in the desert and dressed in a goat skin and eating things from the tree. But then he's very fluent in Latin, so he's sent as a kind of bright young thing on various kinds of missions to Rome. So he's kind of Romanized. When he comes back from Rome, he's made the military commander in his 20s of the Galilean section of the Jewish army that's rebelling against Rome. So he's thrust into this position. By his own account, he's a brave and dauntless commander. We can either believe it or not. But we are all brought up to believe, because there's this crucial moment of him organizing a mass suicide at the siege of Yotapata, out of which he walks completely intact and surrenders to Vespasian and Titus. So we think this is disgusting, creepy turncoat. He accepts the wife the Romans have chosen. He lives in Vespasian's apartment in Rome. But on the other hand, there is this extraordinary, and he doesn't believe that the zealots, for example, he believes essentially that they're kind of jihadi suicide warriors who are dooming all of Jerusalem to destruction for no good reason. And remember, there are great Jewish sages who thought he was right. Yochanan bar Zakkai is smuggled out of Jerusalem, says, liberate me from my meshuggah Jewish terrorist people who are here, so I can go to Yavne and found the first great rabbinical academy of studying the Torah and the oral tradition. So Josephus has allies, but then he does this extraordinary thing, which I find very, very moving. He expects in Rome to be congratulated for being a turncoat. And what he finds is immense sneering. All the other historians are holding their noses at this horrible Jew. And he writes this book called Contra Appian, designed, the first book designed to disabuse the Romans of the shocking stories already going around, how Jews abduct, fatten up Greeks and sacrifice them. What he says is, you must understand that our role in the world has been to provide moral instructions. That is what we have. This is a wonderful phrase. We have become the teachers of men, the teachers of men in the greatest number of things. And he describes how Jews, the greatest mitzvah in effect is to teach your children how to be decent human beings. And it's profoundly moving. He sort of rediscovers his own kind of ethical dignity, I think, at that moment.
Simon Chama is our guest, and his new book and his new documentary on PBS is called The Story of the Jews. It played in the BBC to quite a wide acclaim. And let me just quote from The Story of the Jews. He says, it's a story of suffering and resilience, endurance and creativity. And let me go to some of your emails here. I'll go to your calls as well. We'll get as many of you in as we can. Peter writes, there's a widespread idea among the general public that the majority of Jews today are for the most part biological descendants of people who lived in the region of Palestine, Israel, 3,000 years ago. Can your guest tell us to what degree this is true?
No, he can't. Because he's not. I will say that actually in my book there are good leads, and I don't say this facetiously actually at all, but it is a complicated DNA swabbing has proved an extraordinary degree of genetic transmission, but it's transmission this is where I need my wife, who's a geneticist, with me, Michael. It's essentially the male Y chromosome of the priestly subgroup of Jews, which passes down intact from generation to generation, and that's how that genetic map has been produced all the way down to tropical Africa, famously. The book, if you go to the book, there are, I believe, in the bibliography, there are good leads for you to go to the excellent scientific literature and discussion of this.
You're getting a lot of emails here. This one dovetails with Dr. Chama comment on the recent genetic studies and writings of Tzvi Misenia, showing that a large portion of Palestinians are descendants of the original Jewish populations of what is now Israel?
Well, you know, you hope it's been true, because then we can say, well, hello, everybody. It's all been a terrible misunderstanding. We're actually part of the identical genetic family.
We are Semitic brothers and sisters.
Yes, indeed. But we know that anyway.
Ari wants to know what you think of My Promised Land by Ari Shavit, because it intersects with your own history.
Well, I think it was an extraordinary book. I did not to... I did actually review it in the FT, actually, if you want to see that. But I did think it was a remarkable book in that it was written by an unequivocally, passionately loyal Israeli. But it was prepared to look with unflinching honesty at some of the really terrible things that were done to the Palestinians during the War of Independence. He looks a little more briefly, I had to say, at almost equally terrible things that were done to Jews in the Islamic world at around the same time, perhaps. But I hate this kind of victimization competition. So, you know, I didn't really mind him doing that. It's an extraordinary book. It is actually, I think, the best book written about Israel, certainly over the last 20, 30 years.
Recently had on Aluf Ben, who is the editor-in-chief of Haaretz, where he, of course, is employed.
That's
and
right.
The thing we both said about that book is both narratives are in there. And,
yes,
and a personal story as well, which is one of the
they
things
they are.
That makes
well, this is the thing, Michael, that actually if there's to be any hope of not, you know, Palestinians and Israelis are not going to fall in love with each other, I don't think. I mean, but they have to learn to live side by side with each other. So they have to learn to listen to each other's narrative. It's hopeless to have a kind of competition of suffering, really. We will, I think, win that, but that's neither here nor there. What you want is to sort of acknowledge the kind of authenticity and integrity of each other's calamities, I suppose, of each other's stories.
Well, since we've broached that topic, I have a listener here, Colin, who I think wants to talk about the divestment movement against Israel, Colin?
Good morning, Professor. Actually, my question was exactly regarding that. Larry Summer, when he was still president of Harvard, famously made a remarks at Memorial Church intimating that the divestment movement was, in fact, anti-Semitic. The proponents of the divestment movement for American colleges to divest from companies doing business in Israel have analogized their movement to South Africa and divestment in the 1980s, which was largely did have some impact on the change in government in South Africa. What are your own opinions regarding whether American colleges should divest from Israel?
Excuse me, Colin, but Simon Shum almost may want to comment on your question, but also right now the boycott movement is getting a lot more traction.
The academic boycott movement.
Yes.
I'm not a believer in collective guilt. I'm absolutely hostile to the boycott movement. I think it's appalling. I think it's a betrayal of so many Israelis who do not take the view that settlements can expand indefinitely or even find the settlements, any of them, legitimate. So I think above all in academic life, it is a kind of shocking thing to do. So I'm very much opposed to that, I have to say. I think it's a sort of betrayal of the Israeli opposition. And those who do it should be ashamed of themselves. So that's my view. Now, divestment's a different story because, and actually, with respect to the caller, he's not quite characterized it correctly. There's a distinction between, if we're talking about divesting from the entirety of the Israeli economy, that I'd be very much against, because actually essentially delegitimizes Israel as an economy and as a society. We're talking about divesting from enterprises that do business in the West Bank and with settlements in particular. Here's the Scarlett Johansson thing. That is complicated, I think. I've always been hostile to the settlements. Anybody who's listened to me over the years knows that. I'm particularly hostile to the notion of annexing Judea and Samaria. The more profound issue is, can Israel survive as a Jewish democracy with this enormous Palestinian population? The answer is that was not how Zionism was created, nor was it done for that. What is true about the kind of, what's it called, SodaStream thing, is that there are a lot of Palestinians who are employed who would be out of work, actually, if those enterprises that are attached to Maale Adumim or Ariel were shut down. So it's a tricky thing. But I don't want to say, if I have complicated reflections on that, that I myself endorse the economy of the settlements. I don't.
Let me thank the caller. We'll go to another caller taking us maybe back to more ancient history. Timothy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, Mr. Shama, I believe you made reference to an archaeological site in northern Syria or eastern Turkey that you could not get to. Was this the site that some have categorized as an ancient Jewish synagogue that had fantastically beautiful mural art that depicted humans with animal heads? And if that is to be considered not, say, a Jewish merchant having a restaurant appealing to the non-Jewish populace, if that was in fact a Jewish synagogue, what are the implications for the kind of Judaism, so to speak, that they were practicing?
Thank you for that. We were talking about that a bit earlier, I may be wrong, but I think you're conflating two different things. In the Middle Ages, very often there are representations, as in the famous Bird's Head Haggadah, where in fact there are humans in a beautifully illuminated Haggadah who are given very animated and wonderful bird's heads. But if you're talking about the synagogue, the 3rd century synagogue of Deir Europos in Syria, those frescoes have been removed to the Damascus Museum, where they're safe. But I couldn't, alas, get into Syria at all to film it. But the actual site, we don't know whether it's been in trouble or not, but the wall paintings do not have animal heads at all. They're fully Moses is Moses and Samuel is Samuel and David is David. And there's absolutely no hint of being embarrassed, much less of actually having full human representation in the decoration of synagogues. All these synagogues of late antiquity, virtually all of them we know about, from North Africa through to Asia Minor, are all covered in mosaic floors, many of them with human faces.
I was talking with Narcy David recently, who is of Assyrian background, and actually we were having a conversation about a program I did a while back about all the great antiquities that were essentially destroyed or stolen, mostly stolen, after the Iraq War. Same problems going on in Syria now as we speak.
Yes.
I don't know what's happened to the synagogue, but a lot of antiquities just looted and purloined.
It is just the architectural structure, which, not a huge amount was left. But it's not far from Palmyra, as I understand it. But it's a depressing and frightening prospect. Yeah.
Another listener, Nathaniel, says, great show. It's my understanding that the biblical Song of Songs may have been inspired by or taken from Egyptian love poetry. I wonder if your guests can comment on this and if this is true or not, when and how it came about.
Boy, you're ahead of me there. I didn't know that, which isn't to say that you're not right, but it would certainly be in keeping with the fact that there's a kind of free flow of poetic modes between the Jewish tradition and outside. But it should also be said that the so-called wisdom books are, I mean, it's more likely in a way to be, I would have thought, an early Greek influence, actually.
Isn't Noah's story from Gilgamesh?
Yes. No, I mean, as we were saying, a lot of the stories about, you know, deluges and earthquakes and the thunder god are from a very large so-called West Semitic repertoire. But it is a very Jewish thing to represent the passion for God as an erotic poem, and that's sustained famously by the great medieval poets like Yehuda Halevi and Solomon Ibn Gabiro. And it's a sort of wonderful thing. I mean, we think now that deeply religious and spiritually intense poems cannot at the same time be these extraordinarily impassioned, erotic, lyrical eulogies of the human body, the physical act of a relationship of communion. But Jewish religious literature is the first not to want to make that distinction. I mean, you have an absolutely gorgeous description of the body of a female beloved going on in that poem.
It's a beautiful
you could either
poem.
Say it you know, rather as the metaphysical poets later would do, it encompasses both spiritual and physical contemplation. Or you could say, well, it's the greatest example of having your cake and eating it.
And you did do a film on John Donne where you brought some of this into focus. In fact, Richard writes, how far back, perhaps beyond biblical time, can Jewish existence be traced, into what areas of the world?
Before biblical times, is he saying?
Yeah, asking.
Not at all before biblical times. I think actually that's to say that
Garden of Eden.
We don't have any good evidence about that at all. The very first evidence of any existence, which could be called Israelite, is the famous stele, the stone inscription of the pharaoh Meneptah in the 13th century BC, which refers to Israel's seed being scattered. It's a long list of those who've been punched to death by the omnipotence of the Egyptian pharaoh. And the Jews make their first appearance as a comprehensively defeated bunch. And that's very, very early indeed. So I don't know if that answers the question. In the book, actually, in the one place in Egypt, this extraordinary colony of Jewish mercenary soldiers with all their families, at a place called Elephantine, an island on the Nile, pretty much opposite the city of Aswan now. And there, for the first time, we have incredibly detailed, vivid descriptions of what life was like for the so-called Judean troop, which, independently of the Bible, what their dowries were, who they were, how they celebrated the Sabbath and Passover, typical of Jews, terrible property line disputes, that sort of thing. And that is a fully fleshed out, magnificent source with which I begin the book.
Off the subject for a moment, a listener named David wants to know, will Simon Shama ever make another documentary based on art history like his Power of Art series?
On whose history? Sorry, on...
Art history.
Oh, on art history. Well, I am actually about to make a film about the aged Rembrandt, and that may not actually fit the bill because it's just one big film. There's an exhibition travelling from Holland to London.
I would love to do... Did you do a film on Rembrandt?
I did do one on Rembrandt, yeah, yes, exactly, as part of the Power of Art. No, I would love to do that. It's an expensive proposition for all sorts of reasons, but I could easily do another 8 programmes along the lines of the Power of Art. And I would actually love to, anybody out there, I would love to take the story into the non-European world, into Mesoamerican art and Chinese art and Indian art and so on. That would be a nice thing to do before I kick the bucket, as we say in Britain.
There's a listener who brings up a couple points. Lucy writes, how did someone as mild-mannered as Shama inspire so many brilliant YouTube parodies? The Shama spoofs by one of his supposed former students are some of the funniest things I've ever seen. Is it true that Shama enjoys the spoofs? And
she says,
kind of wonder whether Shama's historical transgression in penning the novelistic Dead Certainties was unconsciously linked to Mailer's novelistic transgression in writing a history in the Armies of the Night. Did they ever meet? Weren't they both hanging around Harvard and Boston in the 80s?
They were. Wow, a lot of questions. Well, first of all, I have to... you are the first and only person who's ever described me as mild-mannered, which isn't to say I am some latter-day incarnation of Norman Mailer, who I did meet and know. That's quite right. And who was an extraordinary in all his aspects, of which you know all about. But no, I you're absolutely right. I did... how clever of you. I did... I certainly didn't consciously think about writing the fiction about writing history, which is Dead Certainties, which I was seriously berated because of Armies of the Night. But was I an admirer of Armies of the Night? I sure was. It may have been... I mean, I did love The Naked and the Dead, which is an astonishing novel, I think. But I did think Armies of the Night was an amazing achievement, as I did, I mean, Cold Blood as well. I mean, I thought there's kind of cross-genre... those cross-genre kind of exercises were remarkable.
They changed the novel.
I think quantum change. Yeah, I think so, Michael, as well. But Dead Certainties was meant to be very clearly, and I failed in its clarity, a work of unapologetic fiction. It wasn't a crossover, about the nature of writing history. And the New York Times, actually, book review, phoned me up and said, well, this is a very interesting book, Mr. Sharma, but we don't quite know whether to review it under non-fiction or fiction. I said, fiction, of course. And they said, right, and they reviewed it under non-fiction. So that's what happens.
Simon Sharma, our guest, I wish we had time for more emails. We can't get to, unfortunately, many of your emails here or your calls. But you can see the five-part series. It begins Tuesday, March 25th and runs April 1st, starting at 8 p.m. on KQED Channel 9. You're going to be appearing here in town, but I think everything's sold out. So, which is good news. But
it is good.
Bad news for those who would like to see you. But so glad we had you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a real pleasure, Michael. Thank you for having me.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion online, by the way, by simply going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. Or, of course, you can email us your thoughts about what you hear on forum or would like to hear on forum. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our interns are Jack Detsch, Marisa Endicott, Mariam Jamil, Hannah Rose Levy, Audrey Gertz, and Daniel Radin. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.